Welcome to Dreaming in Color, a space for social change leaders of color to reflect on how their unique life experiences, personal and professional, have prepared them to lead and drive the impact we all seek. I'm your host, Darren Isom. This season, we're traveling to the continent to highlight African leaders and the continent's role as a key driver of global innovation and leadership. So join us as we travel across the continent, from South Africa to Tunisia, with stops in Kenya, Ethiopia, Nigeria, and Senegal along the way, celebrating the diaspora and all of its complexity and beautiful possibility. This is Dreaming in Color, Africa. And this season, I'm lucky to have my Bridgeband colleague, Elizabeth Makumbi, joining me as a guest co-host. Elizabeth is a social impact consultant and manager with Bridgeband Africa, based in our Joburg office. With a background in law and a career rooted in systems change, she brings a sharp, strategic lens to some of the world's most complex challenges, from climate resilience to equitable access to water and sustainable finance. Prior to joining Bridgeband, she worked at Pegasus Consulting, focusing on climate change and sustainable development across the continent. Elizabeth holds an LLM from Georgetown University, a certificate in systems change and social impact from the UCT Graduate School of Business, and an LLB from the University of Pretoria. A Pan-African at heart, born in Zimbabwe with Ugandan and Kenyan heritage, she channels her expertise into supporting NGOs like the Greater Cape Water Fund and Core Africa, strengthening their governance and impact. At her core, she's a purpose-driven advisor committed to building a more just and sustainable world. And it's a joy to have Elizabeth host today's conversation in Nairobi's beautiful Africa House with the wonderfully brilliant Tom Osborne. Welcome to Dreaming in Color, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Darren. Today's guest is Tom Osborne, a bold thinker, systems innovator, and community-rooted social entrepreneur. Born and raised in Kenya to sugarcane farmers, Tom's journey has taken him from rural Kenya to Harvard and from local challenges to global recognition. At just 18, he co-founded GreenChar, a clean energy company that brought affordable cooking fuel to underserved communities, earning him a spot on Forbes 30 Under 30 and a distinction of being the youngest Echoing Green Fellow. Today, Tom is founder and CEO of Shamira Institute, Africa's largest youth mental health provider. Using evidence-based, culturally grounded approaches to mental health, his work bridges global research and local knowledge, reaching over 100,000 young people across Africa with care that is accessible, affordable, and deeply resonant. Widely recognized for his leadership in social innovation, community building, and entrepreneurship, Tom is also the author of What We Can't Burn, a memoir on friendship, friction, and global energy transition. Please join me in welcoming the wonderful Tom Osborne to this episode of Dreaming in Color. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm great. Just excited for this conversation.
Excellent. And we would love to start this conversation with an invocation. An invitation, if you will, to ground the conversation. And it can be anything from a verse or a song. Something that hums to you, but will resonate with others. What is yours today, Tom?
So I'm reading from actually a book that I wrote. Just going to read one paragraph. I was born on a sugarcane farm in the heart of a rural Kenyan village called Nyobera. I was born on an early Sunday morning in June. Ordinarily, they would have named me Omondi. He was born in the morning. But instead, my dad gave me two white names, Tom Osborne.
That is perfect. And actually leads us quite nicely into our first question for you, which is we also found out that you were born in rural Kenya to the son of two sugarcane farmers. And for many, where you grew up, how you were raised, and our family and community really often lay the foundation of our values. So Tom, tell us a bit about how your upbringing shaped your worldview and what some of the core principles or lessons you learned growing up continue to guide and shape your work today.
Yeah, so I have three siblings. We are all 4 years apart from each other because our parents didn't want to pay for college fees for more than one person at the same time.
I get that.
Which is great family planning. So being raised in a small rural community, it's a pretty communal upbringing. You know, so you, yes, belong to your nucleus family, but you're pretty much, you know, kind of like seen as a kid who belongs to the whole community. And so for me, that was really important because there are important decisions that my small rural community made that affected me personally, which, you know, kind of have oriented me towards this community first lens that I do take to a lot of the work that I do. And the first was when I was, I think about 4 or 5 years old. They realized that we had one school and village, and they realized that, like, that school wasn't going to be, you know, good enough to match my academic aspirations. And so they did call it in Harambe, but it's just basically like fundraising as a village. And I was moved into staying initially briefly with my uncle, who was a teacher in a small town nearby, to, you know, kind of like get, you know, kind of a better education outside of, you know, kind of what is available in the village. The second thing from this upbringing was just how difficult it is for young people, especially in this type of context, to be able to, you know, actualize your life potential. So when I grew up, we had this thing called an age group. So an age group is about the people who are born around the same year. So traditionally, you'll go through life together, you know, get married around the same time, etc. But in my age group, there were about 12 of us, and only two of us will go through to high school, and I'll be the only one who, you know, kind of will graduate from college. You know, for me, something which really is profound, because I don't see myself as being better or more talented, etc. It's just like the different type of decisions that the community made at different type of points allowed me to have opportunities, you know, that people didn't have, right? And so basically, you know, kind of from my upbringing, the two things which, you know, kind of stand with me, one is, you know, kind of adopting, you know, kind of a community first approach to a lot of the initiatives that I'm doing. Just this idea of agency and trying to expand the pool of opportunities that people have access to, so that they can, you know, be agents who can actualize their life dreams and potential however defined.
I love that. And one of the through lines for our discussions today will be that around that community first. But before we jump into that, just sticking a bit with the broader scheme, about you often talk about social issues, and which can often be said as being quite broad and abstract. But I really appreciate how you've been able to anchor it in your lived human experiences. Ensuring something as vast and systemic as climate change can actually have an immediate and personal impact on individual lives. So just branching off from what you've said, what experiences in your own life first revealed that connection between the personal and systemic to you?
Well, I love that the social issues that I have been thinking about and normally begin from a personal connection, right? So, for example, I spent my earlier time as an entrepreneur working on a clean energy venture, but I was doing it mostly because of the story of my mom, you know. So growing up in rural Kenya, we primarily used firewood as a primary source of cooking. And this leads to a lot of respiratory tract infections, especially affecting women. And I think at that point, this was 10 years ago, about 3 million women around the world suffering from this type of respiratory tract infection. So my mom was one of them. You know, so when I was in high school, she had this really bad, like, respiratory tract illnesses. And I felt that I needed to do something to solve that problem, you know, kind of for her initially, and then more broadly for the other women. And so that's what brought me to this conversation. And so as I started, like, thinking about how can we design clean cooking feel, then I realized there's also like a climate and energy transition part around this. And at that point, and still up to date, sometimes brings a form of tension, especially just to use the climate space as an example, between folks who are coming at it from a purely climate perspective, so thinking about, like, you know, CO2 emissions, and how do we do this energy transition. And I do find this often removes the lived experience of people who actually really go through it and turns it into super, you know, kind of like abstract issues, right? And so just basically grounding, you know, these social issues on people is kind of a framework which I find to be, you know, kind of really powerful. I think also which makes most sense in our African context, because, you know, we are mostly a people community first, and so it's easier to direct resources and attention around issues like helping moms, like my mom, move from charcoal and firewood to cleaner fuels than, you know, reducing our carbon emissions as a country, for example. Yeah.
So as someone with a climate background, I've spent the last 7 years in climate change, and I desperately fall into bucket number one, which is I just get caught up in the verbose terms that we use and just often struggle to think about how climate change is actually about people and livelihoods at the center of all of it. So just hearing you talk about that also just makes me realize how much I need to also internalize how I also position climate change and what it actually means in terms of my job. But as we journey on in this conversation, one of the things we picked up is that you traveled from rural Kenya to Harvard. And that's just not a story of academic achievement, but also one of identity and belonging. So how did you navigate these different worlds? And how did they shape your sense of purpose and influence your decision to return home to Kenya? But while you niggle on that, what does it also mean to you to create impact from within rather than from afar?
Well, yeah, that's a big one. So when I was 14, we did this national end of primary school exam, which everyone does in Kenya. And the way it works, it almost, I normally tell my American friends, it's almost like a draft. So you do the exam and then the schools are ranked. And so the first ranked school has a first choice of kids from around the country. And I'd wanted to go to this school called Starehe, which is a school in Nairobi. And primarily the reason I wanted to go to the school, it was explicitly set up for kids from like low income backgrounds and communities who cared about changing the world. But that year, Starehe was ranked third. So the first ranked school was called Alliance. And so they admitted me. And I didn't want to go to this school, Alliance, because it's historically known in Kenya to produce, if there's a corruption scandal or something bad which is happening in the country, there will be someone from Alliance.
Points there.
Gotcha. Yeah, bro. Anyway, so I went to that school. And that's where I first had my identity conversation. So two things. One is, so it was my first time out of the village to Nairobi. And everyone thought I was a white kid because of my white names. And so obviously when I showed up, they were all really disappointed. You know, when I showed up, some like random kid from the village with a thick low accent is not kind of what they had in their mind. But the school made me realize that my, like, you know, so basically because everyone in the school was smart. So like in the first exam, I think I was ranked 70th, which was kind of a big shock to my system. But over time, I just realized that, yes, I was academically gifted, but I wasn't going to be the most academically gifted person, and kind of where I had an initial role to play will be in working with people who are smart and more talented than me and getting them to, you know, kind of like do things in the real world. And I had this great opportunity to go to Harvard for undergrad, which was, well, it was really difficult, I think, from a culture shock perspective, you know, so moving from Kenya to America, trying to find a place where I fit within. Yes, for example, it's the first time I think about race, you know, like, you know, yeah. Being a Kenyan, you never really think about race. Then I was in the US, now I have to think about race. And then also realizing within like the black community, there's also like segments and inter-politics between this, you know, kind of like different segments, right? And starting to figure out like, what is my post-college pathway? And I always knew I was going to come back to Kenya, but it was reinforced by every time I came back home. The way I explain it to folks here is if you're going to CBD Nairobi, most likely you're not going to get robbed, but you have a sixth sense that you're going to get robbed. So you're just walking and navigating it very tensely.
Okay.
And that's how I felt being a black man in America, right?
Wow.
Like something is not going to, may most likely won't happen,
yeah.
But there's like this sixth sense, which makes it, you know, kind of just a really tense experience. And so that just really confirmed to me that I had to, you know, kind of like move back to Kenya. I think this hopefully also encourages other people, because I think we do have a lot of great talented folks who leave the continent, go to Europe and the US for school, but just never come back. And I think that's, you know, one of the reasons why we end up with poor, ineffective leadership is most people, you know, just choose not to come back, right? And so given, you know, all of these things that I was mentioning earlier also about community, I knew that I had to come back and try to be part of the solution here.
Got it. And similar to you, I was also studying in the US. I was in a chocolate city or Washington, D.C. So I didn't get that sense of fear, I will say. That wasn't you. But I did have a sense of that I didn't belong at some times. And it was really interesting because I loved D.C. It's just this cosmopolitan transitional city where honestly it felt like I could be anything. But there still was a stage where I knew that whatever I became, home was still where I needed to go back to. And it kind of just drew me back and pulled me through. So really, really interesting. And also, I think there's also one of those things that points at when we were kids, like everyone wanted to go to US and Europe because of the great PR that it had. But the truth is when you get there, exactly everything you're talking about, there are more social issues there. There are things that they're also grappling with that just make it even more important for us to come home, to be honest. And so I want to go back to something else you mentioned around your clean energy with Green Char. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Perfect. So when I read about it, it was fascinating that you're just kind of working the intersection of deforestation and waste to energy. And your story about your mom just also brought it to life in such a beautiful way. But then we note that you shift your focus from that to mental health with founding Shamiri, which we understand means to thrive in Kiswahili. These are two very different yet deeply impactful stories. So what inspired that pivot? And what did you see in Kenya's mental health landscape for young people that made you feel compelled to build something so novel and so new?
Yeah, so there's three reasons why I decided to make this pivot. So the first, which is generally a tension we have in the quote-unquote international development space, is we have to make this trade-off between, on the one hand, like innovation and accessibility, right? So I was at Green Char, basically what we were doing is we were turning sugarcane waste into clean and burning charcoal. But the solution to clean cooking is not clean and burning charcoal, right? Like from an innovation perspective, you know, they are way more, you know, kind of efficient tools and systems out there. But the consequence is because we are quote unquote innovating for the bottom of the pyramid, we often, you know, kind of like find ourselves making poorer version of products that wouldn't fly in any other demographic for the quote unquote bottom of the pyramid. And so that, from an intellectual perspective, was something which I didn't really like about the work that we were doing. The second is more from a personal, you know, kind of perspective. What ended up happening with Green Char is it mostly a supply chain and operation play because the margins are so small. And so all the innovation is how do you reduce cost and, you know, kind of increase output, which I realized I didn't have, you know, I was 19, 20, 21, yes. And I was running in trials. So I just didn't have the skill set, you know, sure. Kind of like to want to do that. And then finally, we got in some investment, which decided to pivot the company away from a B2C approach to a B2B approach, which made more sense from both the revenue and a climate perspective. But as I mentioned to begin with, you know, I had come in this because of my mom and because of the people. And so I think when that shift, you know, kind of arrived, which made a lot of business sense, I think it just made sense for me to like, you know, transition out of it. And I didn't anticipate going into mental health at all. You know, so when I went to college initially, I was studying economics with a focus on like environmental and energy policy because, you know, that really made a lot, you know, of sense. But then I had to take a psychology class because it was a required class, you know, that I had to take. And so as I took this class, I realized, you know, for the first time that a lot of my experiences, you know, kind of like growing up, which I hadn't seen from a mental health and well-being experiences, you know, actually mental health and well-being conversations, you know. And for example, growing up, I had to go to public boarding school, but from a pretty, you know, kind of like early age, we were in a super pressure cooker environment. I had a few friends who either dropped out of school, one who committed suicide, but kind of how I went through all of these things was, this is just life, you know, this is the card that you handed, and, you know, you basically just wake up, dust yourself. So I hadn't seen it from this, you know, mental health experience. It gave me this framework where I could look back to my own lived experience and be like, wow. And those of, you know, kind of people I had, you know, around me. So that was like the initial, you know, kind of like pull. And then the second pull was just now starting to spend more time, you know, like starting this just realizing how much of an issue that is starting to become across the continent, primarily because of the youthful nature of the population. So we are a pretty young continent, and it's a lot of like social pressure on young people to do well, but we don't have a clear pathway for young people to like actualize, you know, their life outcomes. And so just that realization, you know, made me want to spend more time studying this. So I joined a lab at Harvard where they were like trying to build out the psychological interventions. And that's when the third inspiration came to me, where there was all of these great academicians who are developing and doing RCTs on these great interventions. But once they wrote the manuscript, that was pretty much the end of the work with this, right? So I just saw this great potential to turn some of this like research into real life, you know, interventions that could impact people.
So could you tell us more about it? As in, how was it ultimately appreciated and endorsed when you came back to Kenya to tackle an issue which often isn't spoken about?
Yeah, so we actually realized that mental health seems stigmatized, but only insofar as you're applying a Western lens towards it, right? So to give a more concrete example with depression, right? So if you, at least the communities that we were working with in Kenya, so if you go and you try to ask people if they're depressed and all that type of stuff, like it will be stigmatized. But if you do break it down to its constituent things, like, you know, are you having trouble sleeping? Have you been overthinking? Things like that, right? You realize that those are things people are going through, and they already have their own, you know, kind of like ways of trying to deal with it, mostly, you know, religious or social, etc., right? And then the second thing we realized was it actually makes sense for mental health to be stigmatized if you really take a close look at the history of quote-unquote formal mental health care in the continent. It's a very violent history. For example, in the Kenyan context, the freedom fighters, the Mau Mau, were diagnosed with mass psychosis, and that was used as the rationale for setting up this like detention camps to mass detain, you know, kind of community. So it makes sense, you know, from that history for mental health to be stigmatized. And so to navigate that, what we realized we needed to do was to orient our way of thinking about care on communities, right? And just realizing that a lot of mental health caregiving is already happening at community level. So be it at the family level, at the church, at the mosque level, at the school level. And the challenge is the quote-unquote formal mental health system is built outside of this. It's built in hospitals, in more formal traditional clinics, etc. And so the way our model ended up working was working within communities. Right now we work in schools, but we're also trying to work with churches and mosques. And utilizing those resources from that community. So in schools, like working with like recent high school graduates to go back to their schools as the, you know, kind of first form of care, you know, mobilizing other locally available resources like social workers, school counselors, etc. And then eventually, you know, triaging into the existing systems of care. So I think just like moving away from using this Western-derived diagnostic criteria, which there's a separate conversation, but I do think might be completely erroneous, and then orienting care in communities rather than the one-on-one type way that we think about mental health in the West has really allowed us, since we started doing this in 2021, to scale to serving like at least 100,000 people every year, which is pretty large. Yeah, so that's how we've been going through it.
So without realizing, we wanted to actually double click a lot on that, which is when we read through a lot of your literature. For example, you did publish a study around decolonizing mental health in Africa. You did frame it around this idea of going from the community first rather than a Western idea of employing more of an individualistic approach. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah. So basically my philosophy, which may end up being wrong, but my philosophy is that the way we think about mental health, which is 100% American-centric, is wrong, right? Like we think about mental health problems as diseases, but all of these assumptions don't make sense. So for example, with malaria, we know malaria is a disease because it has a very specific cause a very specific set of symptoms. An antimalarial drug only treats malaria, not other diseases. But for mental health, all of these assumptions are wrong. So depression has a lot of different causes. What causes depression also causes anxiety. The symptoms are different even within the same culture. There's a lot of comorbidity. CBT or therapy works for depression, anxiety. So it's kind of like quite complicated. But now the challenge that we've had is we have quote unquote exported the American gold standard approach around the whole, around the world. And that I think contributes to not just the stigma, but also just like the outcomes for most people who go through this. Therapy is pretty bad. I think it's just only slightly better than chance. So what we are calling for is a new way of thinking about mental health, which also appreciates and accepts that very violent colonial history of mental health and its introduction, you know, across African countries. Apart from just like communities, one thing we are calling from is also moving away from a full emphasis on these formal diagnoses, which we think, yes, they're reliable, but they may not be valid diagnoses on in themselves, and moving more to thinking about care from like a symptom level and also like a recovery slash functioning level rather than a formal diagnosis and the treatment of that diagnosis. And we think that can allow us to think about what mental health is in Africa for Africans, also requires us to be slightly brave to, you know, be able to like stand up and be like, we think the West has gotten it wrong. And rather than trying to replicate this, we're going to try and build something from scratch. And that's how we also need to publish these studies, because unfortunately, that's the only way you get credibility is you have to, you know, publish studies and do all of these RCTs. Sure. Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, I deeply appreciate the localized approach. And one of the things I alluded to when we started this conversation was around the through line of community first. I just want to delve in a bit deeper there around what first inspired you to take this community-centered approach, or community first as you have coined it. And what have you learned about how healing works when it happens collectively?
Wow, yeah, that's a great question. So I've always believed that, you know, those closer to the problem are closer to the solution. Problems are normally not siloed, right? So if you are, for example, struggling with a mental health problem, it affects your partner, your family, your ability to, you know, kind of like navigate, school, for example, if you're a student, right? And so all of these different elements have to be involved in quote unquote your healing, because all these different elements are either contributing to or affected by the problem, you know, kind of to begin with. That is why, for example, the work that we do is, if we're working with students, it's school-based, you know, so trying to work with them, you know, in a very non-stigmatizing way within the school, you know, community, and trying to rope in their teachers and their friends and peers as part of like this group-based work that we do, right? And the beauty of that is we think it really normalizes it, because I think once you start doing it the one-on-one way, it contributes to almost like othering people, like, you know, they are going through something that they need to sit to some corner and, you know, kind of solve for themselves, to more of an approach where, you know, we're working together as a group for both individual and collective, you know, healing, right? So that's the inspiration behind this community first approach, is you just basically need to realize that, and so realize that we are not, you know, kind of silos, and all of these issues we are facing, be it mental health or climate, etc., affects us both individually and collectively. And then how can you tap into the power of like community to basically, you know, like solve for that? So I forgot the second part of the question.
I think you answered it, but at the same time, maybe I will push you on it, which is, what have you learned about how healing has worked, and maybe anything else that comes to mind around it?
So the one thing which has surprised us is just so when we got into this work, at least on the mental health side, like we thought that, okay, this was really stigmatized, like kids in schools were not going to sign up for this, right? But on average, you have about like an 80% like sign up rate in secondary schools, which has been quite surprising. And so I think for me, maybe the thing which I've learned is people are actually excited about sociability and community, and maybe are more increasingly seeking it today. And so it's just something great to think about tapping into.
I agree. And it also really leans into the work that we do, which is around something I'm working with is around community-driven change, where we are thinking a bit more around exactly what you said, that communities know the problems that they're facing and actually probably even know the solutions to it. It is not for funders to come in and say it, but to support it instead. And so it's not just about giving philanthropy and leaving, but actually thinking about how do you work with the communities to really solution-based and actually ensure that you have enduring, lasting impact, because they are part of the architecture of building the ultimate really solution to sometimes something really wicked problems. So deeply, deeply resonated with that. And it's something that we're also hoping to mainstream a bit more. But in terms of our next question, so you've spoken a bit about how mental health is a space that allows for deep innovation. Because when we really think about it, no country or healthcare system has really figured out a solution to the universal challenges of mental health care, which is what you've said, right? Yeah. In terms of you can't just adopt what's already been used. It probably does need a bit more depth and localization. But you've also been able to achieve a significant scale and impact with Shamari in a very, very
short time. Yeah,
very short time. So thank you for acknowledging that.
Yeah.
But what are some of those strategies that have enabled you to reach so many young people and build trust within your community?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So when we think about the work we do, and you'd love this because, you know, consultants love frameworks.
I love a framework.
So we are guided by what you call the four enoughs framework.
Tell me more.
As we're trying to replicate, right? And so the first of them is just this idea of, is our model good enough, right? So like, is it actually leading to like consequential, you know, impact in the lives of the people, you know, kind of that matter. And here, you know, there are two things to put in place. So the first is from like a research and rigor perspective, you know, you do need like a higher confidence level in, you seem like a 95 or 99% confidence interval that, you know, you're reducing the rates of like depression or anxiety amongst like the population that you're working with. But then on the other side, from the student and the parent and the school perspective, you know, where they care really more about, we've realized what good enough is for them is, you know, just better social relationships, maybe better academic grades, better strengthening like the parent-student, you know, kind of relationship. So figuring out what these indices are has been pretty good way for us to scale up, because then we can set up, you know, kind of like a benchmark and be like, okay, we may not be able to lead for all of the 100,000 people we're working with, lead to like significant reductions in depression. But if we're helping them, you know, succeed in school, build better social relationships, then we think that is good enough for us to continue. The second part, which has actually really helped us figure out how to scale much quickly is this idea of big enough. But here it's mostly about figuring out the constraints about where our model can't work and optimizing for where our model can work best, right? So in theory, we can work across all secondary schools in Kenya. But in practice, you know, we found it easier to work in Nairobi and Kiambu because, you know, it's more urban, it's easier to recruit and train people. And so we started just by like being like economy reach saturation in schools in Nairobi and Kiambu County before, you know, kind of moving to others. And then the last two are this idea of simple enough. So we don't do our model on our own. We work also with like small community-based partner organizations. Mm-hmm. And so we actually do think of them as our actual client, right? So basically, how do we make our model simple enough for them to be able to like replicate, you know, on their own with minimal, you know, kind of like supervision? Because I know that's really helped us scale quite quickly, is basically just packaging this, training other small organizations and having them work within their communities. And then eventually the last one is the idea of cheap enough. So just making sure that because someone eventually has to pay for it, right? And that's a constraint we have to like innovate around and just, so our cost right now is about $7 per person per year, which is pretty cheap, but that's what we think either the government or the parents or philanthropy can pay for.
Great. And I think anyone who's listened to this podcast will know that we love an analogy about food. And so you've given us all these ingredients that we can make something really great out of. But I would love to know from you, which of the elements do you believe could make for a blueprint that we can use beyond Kenya and really is trans-seasonal and transcendent in terms of how we can really deeply innovate in the mental health space going forward?
Well, that's a tough question.
You can name like the two that you think, if your listener was listening to, they would need to know these two things as they go forward.
So in the mental health space, the first thing I'd say is not being 100% like bought on what the quote unquote gold standard is, and being willing to think outside of those confines, right? So just because we have a formal diagnosis for depression, anxiety, and all of these things, and we have a formal way of thinking about how to treat it because of this diagnosis, doesn't mean we always have to adopt our approach, right? If we can orient ourselves, and because these are not issues which are new, right? Before the Americans came up with the DSM and classified as depression, like communities were dealing with these issues and had their own healing practices around these issues, right? And so if we can like think outside of what formal psychiatry has offered us, that presents us more avenues, you know, kind of like for innovation. And then the second is thinking about recovery from the standpoint of the end user. Because one of the challenges we faced when we started this work is we'd go to a parent and we'd be like, we measured depression pre-post and your kid had a 30% reduction. And they'd be like, what the hell does that,
what the hell does that
you know, kind of like mean, right?
Sure.
But when we started thinking about it from like the perspective of things which made sense for them, you know, so just your kid is in school for more days, right? Or they're seeing some improvement in the academics, or better, you know, kind of social relationships, you know, and so basically orienting how we're thinking about recovery in the ways that make sense for the communities that you're working with, rather than always sticking to this more formal way of, you know, symptom reduction, et cetera.
So translating it back into that lived human experience.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's really great. And I'm going to ask you to keep your solution hat still on, as we move into a different space, which is, you've spoken quite candidly about the challenges of building a social enterprise more broadly, particularly as a young person, navigating limited experience, funding, and credibility. So from your journey with GreenChar, which you started at 18, which is right?
Yeah.
Still can't believe it. And then founding Shamari Institute, what are some of the most valuable lessons you've learned about leading and sustaining impact?
I think the main thing for me, especially when I was doing this as a young entrepreneur, and one is, yes, I do have a background in psychology, but I'm not an expert, right? So I think the through line in all of these ventures I've studied is I am not the domain expert. And I think that has called me to lead with vulnerability and just being like, okay, what I am really bringing to the table here is I can make dots between, I can make out patterns, I can mobilize resources and get people towards vision. But, you know, obviously, like, it will be the field domain experts who will get it done. So basically leading from the perspective that as a leader, you know, I can't always have the answers or lead with like clarity, you know, because we're all, you know, kind of figuring this out. And I think just being very like honest about that, I think has been one really great lesson for me. I think the second thing, which is just an encouragement to other social entrepreneurs and especially those from the African continent, is just being more open about the playing field not being level and trying to level it. So I think, just to be more concrete, when I started doing this, I think funders had too many power, and sometimes they will feel bad if you, or like their ego will be threatened if you tried pushing back and being like, okay, you know, I'm the one who is here in Kenya, we know what's happening, this is kind of what we're doing, right? But I think over the last 3-4 years, at least in my experience, people starting to appreciate when us as founders put our foot on the ground and be like, okay, we are the proximal leaders, right? And we are actually giving you this great opportunity to be part of the impact that we're doing, right? And so we need to have the conversation from that capacity as equals. Yes, I need your money, but I'm also giving you this great opportunity, you know, to have impact, which is your job, right? And sure. So basically trying to level that playing ground, because I think especially in the continent, it hasn't been really leveled, and it's still not leveled because most of the money we get is from the West, right? And I think the third one, which is just emerging from all of these recent issues we are facing, is we need to rethink sustainability. I need to rethink the models that we're having towards models that allow us to be able to get and keep money locally. I don't have an exact answer for it, right? But if we can find ways either to innovate and get our target beneficiaries to pay for this, or figure out how to get the government to pay for this, or how to raise, you know, kind of more local money and local resources, I think that begins to win us off this extreme dependence on the West, which you think, insofar as we do have that dependence in the West, our ability to innovate will be severely, you know, kind of handicapped. So we do need to find ways of like rethinking sustainability and trying to build models that can be sustainable without Western funding.
Tom, I don't know where you were a year ago, but I probably could have heard the speech 1 year ago. I mean, for me, I inherited, so I didn't found at 18, but I inherited a social enterprise. And our goal was, which in itself has probably caused its demise, but was to help the brightest young minds in particularly Africa. And it was just as broad as it sounds. But like you said, the challenge we had was that when we asked for money, we didn't really feel that we had the agency to ask for what we needed. And instead, funders told us what we needed to do. And so we would almost mold into whatever we needed to be in order to unlock money, and ultimately lost our purpose. But just listening to you and hearing about just the confidence to just be able to say that actually I have the localized solutions and I know what this entity is meant to do. And so, yes, you may have the money, but if this is not a partnership, it's probably not going to work, was probably the courage that I needed back then. Ultimately ended up closing, but that's a story for another day. But I think it's really something that I hope others who are struggling in that space are hearing.
Yeah, and I'm also cognizant that now, and I was listening to another episode of the podcast where they were talking about this. I'm also cognizant that, you know, now, you know, because I went to Harvard and I'm a second time founder and we have, you know, kind of this early success, you know, like I am able to be a little bit more like courageous. I'm also, you know, kind of like cognizant about that. But I think it does begin with initially, you know, kind of folks who maybe have the credentialing and have, you know, kind of like the networks beginning to set the standard that this is absolutely kind of what should be expected. But I do agree with you. And I think we just need to start getting people to have more that courage, but also on the funder side for them to start having more humility.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And like you said, unlocking more domestic sources would also be great
100%.
Alongside that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you also had said this throughout our conversation today around Africa being a young population. In fact, you might be the third person or second who has said this, because it's just becoming more and more telling. Yeah. And so many of the solutions to local problems will come from young leaders, particularly like yourself. So what is your vision for the next generation of African change makers, particularly in the realm of mental health and social entrepreneurship? And how do you hope your work will help shape the future?
Yeah, I'm really excited about the new generation of change makers in the continent, and especially in Kenya. I think the last 1.5 years has just been really inspiring, just seeing how willing young people are to demand for change and, you know, make change happen. And I think that's, you know, just gives me a lot of like excitement. I think what I hope my work does is presents an exemplar for how you move from wanting to do change and executing on that change, right? And I think a big part of how we're going to do that will need young people to build local solutions and local companies for local problems, right? And so I hope, you know, kind of the work that I am doing and others are doing, you know, starts to be able to provide exemplars and role models, okay, that, you know, this is what you can do and this is how you can do it, right? And so that really, you know, keeps me going. But more broadly, you know, like on the climate change space, sustainability space, mental health, social change space, I think we're really lucky as a continent. You know, one example I used to give people when I was in the US is I had no idea there was like a climate change denialist movement until I moved to the US, because in Kenya, you know, everyone likes environment and fights with environment, etc. Right? And I think this just goes across board for most of the social issues. And now that we are starting to demand better governance and accountability from, you know, those who are in systems of power, I think it will, in my hope, allow us to like catalyze just this new generation of young people who have already had enough of the status quo, but are also willing to stand up and be counted as being part of the solution.
This means we have come to the conclusion of our wonderful chat.
No, thank you so much.
Yeah. No, thank you, Tom. And I think for me personally, there were just so many different nuggets that I'm going to take home. But I think maybe two of them that were really poignant to me was around, firstly, the lived human experience. Like you've said, I am a consultant, a lawyer by training, so I love a framework. But like breaking it down or boiling it down to its most simple elements, which is how is it going to impact people? How does it affect people? And just really leading more with the heart as opposed to always my mind is something that I'm going to take away from you. But also just be courageous. I think you said it once, but I will not lie to you. I am just brimming with the idea of the fact that I do understand my community and the localized needs of it. And so I can be courageous in saying this is what they need or what we need in order to go forward. And with that, thank you so much.
No, thank you. I really loved the conversation.
Perfect.
Great.
Tom's work reminds us that innovation doesn't have to look like Silicon Valley. It can look like communities healing together, students reclaiming joy, and young people standing up to shape systems that once excluded them. As someone raised by a powerful and stoic Kenyan mother who left Kenya to live in South Africa, away from her own community, I often reflect on how terms like mental health, climate justice, community, and social entrepreneurship were absent from my vocab. These concepts simply weren't part of my household. So it wasn't until much later in life that I began to understand their significance. So hearing Tom share his journey from the sugarcane fields to championing community-driven mental health brought me back to my own path of realization. Now, I recognize how these once distant ideas are becoming the very bedrock of our lives. They are shaping how we dream, how we build, and how we show up for ourselves and for our communities. These pillars, mental well-being, environmental stewardship, and systems change, are not only defining the path forward for the next generation, they're also guiding us now as we pause to consider our role in the world and how we serve others and how we care for ourselves, not just physically, but mentally too. If this conversation stirred something in you, share it forward. And as always, keep dreaming in color.
Once again, we put some music with the magic, collecting the theme songs from our season's guests and collaborators to create a Spotify playlist for our listeners to enjoy. Find it on Spotify, under Dreamy and Color, the continent. Thanks for listening to Dreamy and Color. A special shout out to all the folks who make the magic happen. From Africa Inside Communications, our wonderful producers, Mzute Piri and Tom Kirkwood, production coordinator, Gadik Aremba, audio-visual editor, Amamo Giko, graphic designer, Ernest Chikuni, and the amazing production crews on the ground in each country. A huge shout out to my Bridgeband production colleagues, Cora Daniels, my ever-brilliant partner in Good Trouble, and Elizabeth Makumbi, my Joburg-based season co-host. And of course, our fabulous creative director, Ami Diane. What a squad, y'all. Be sure to rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Catch you next time.